Sunday, November the 7th, 1943. Alf Files Diary. Typical Sunday morning. People going to church opposite. Plenty of firing last night, and church has lost a few windows. After breakfast, a dozen MEs came over and made trouble but left us alone. They made for the main road. Ah, now before the first mass can happen, we have to hide our beds. I'm walking to the cookhouse through a conglomerate of American foxholes and guns. The Yanks sound their air raid alarm. It's noisier than the air raid. Americans started running in all directions. I didn't. It was highly unlikely the planes could spot us in this heavily wooded position. They roar over the top of us, and later we hear them machine gunning and bombing somewhere down the Rocamanfina Road. Along with Edgenon, we explore the church annex, and find a piano in the vestry. Soon, Italians at worship in the church can distinctly hear Cole Porter tunes. A priest appears. He's not hostile, and stays to listen. I think his name was Father Alboghetti. He took over the piano and then sang arias from La Boheme and Tosca in a quivery ecclesiastical voice. Oh, we were all having fun. Aren't you glad we liberated you? I said to the priests. Edgerton explained, Aren't you excited we've liberated you? He said. He nearly got it right. I do an all-night stint in the command post in promise of all day off. It's bloody cold, and in between fire orders, we crouch over the brazier. The 6 o'clock news from the BBC is good. Kiev in Russian hands after a terrific advance. I'm so broke, I could do with an advance myself. We're playing pontoon for matchsticks. There's a rumour that a gunner's rest camp has been established somewhere on the Sorrento Peninsula. Is it true? Guns continue to fire through the night. The fight for Monte Camino continues. It's a bloody affair. In boredom, I write some letters home. Dear Dad, nothing much to report except World War II. Is it still going on where you are? It's winter here, lots of mud, very cold, especially in the mornings. So the balaclava and the gloves Mum sent me are very useful. Writing this in a cave, so we haven't come far from Neanderthal man, have we? There's always rumours of going home. One looks at this mop and you realise that we're all going home. Thanks for the three Life magazines. One reads and rereads them over and over again, and they are usually passed through every gunner in the battery. I'm desperately trying to think of any news, and there isn't any. I read Beatcombe in the Express. He explained it all. I'm here, and you're there, and every day is much the same as the previous one. The conversations are food, sex, and after the war. Sometimes it's war, food, and after the sex. I'll have to close, as we're about to start sending deliveries of steel to the gentlemen of the Third Reich. Love to all, your loving son, Terry. P.S. The Major tells us we must win the war because we're British. Tuesday, November the 9th, 1943. What's this? Edgington has made an incredible find. A free-range harmonium. It's in the vicarage, and the priest says we can use it. So, the morning is spent playing jazz. As a mark of respect for the church, I play my trumpet muted. Alf plays guitar, and the priest and his lady cleaner sit and listen. A bit amazed they are. Jazz and the Mussolini has been banned as decadent. Well, the music wasn't, but we certainly were. It was an unusual morning, the priest giving us an unexpected blessing before we departed. What was he doing then, said Edgington. I explained, it's a blessing. What good does it do, he said. Well, it's supposed to be a solemn occasion on which he, as a minister, fortifies your soul by drinking holy water over you. It only may be bloody wet, said Edgington. Grim news of the fighting in Monte Cassino. The guards are attacking, but Jerry has reinforced his position with first 104 Panzer Grenadiers, and fighting is raging all over the peak. November the 10th, 1943. My diary. Much the same. Bad weather. Went into the village of Terra Corpo. It's almost in ruins. We're trying to get a photograph taken of ourselves by an arte photographer. And he says, domani, tomorrow. He says that every day. Tomorrow takes a long time to arrive in Italy. More rain, sleet, more wind. Just up the road before the village are a few houses. One is occupied by RHQ. It is owned by Dr. Fabrizi, who was in the Abyssinian campaign. He went there to play some music for the RHQ signallers. It was a cosy, large front room, nicely furnished, with a piano. We played some jazz. The doctor, who looked like Cesar Romero, showed us some photographs from the Abyssinian War, and a ghastly collection they were. They showed atrocities committed on Italian soldiers, which mostly meant emasculating them with a knife and letting them bleed to death. A scandal. The wife of the Italian doctor fancies our medical officer, Dr. Bentley. Will he end up with his photo in the album? And somehow, they get down to Naples and spend a naughty weekend there. Oh, a touch of the Ernest Hemingways. It has rained now continuously for 5 days. Sergeant Donaldson tells me that the guns are in a bad state. The carriages are starting to warp so badly that 15 and 18 batteries are being pulled out of action. I wish to God my carriage would warp, I said. You know what they're going to do to reinforce them? Well, railway lines around the front and the two sides. I suppose that means all the bloody trains will stop running. Sergeant Donaldson was up for some kind of vehicle inspection. I don't know how the bloody things are still working. He was going on about the road conditions. They've organised a one-way system. Half the day it's up traffic and the other half down traffic. If you come up early, you have to wait half the bloody day before the down system comes in. Don't come up or down, I said. Come sideways, like the Chinese. He stayed to have lunch with us, a lovely stew. We sat under the altar of the church, eating and telling dirty jokes. It was a bad day for God. Thursday, November the 11th, 1943. Armistice Day? What a joke. Lieutenant Johnny Walker is at an OP on Monte Croce. He is suspicious that a white farmhouse is harbouring the enemy, so he drops a few 200-pound shells around it. As they get closer, a door bursts open and out rush a Jerry patrol who runs like hell to a farmhouse 100 yards away. Walker then shells that place again. Out runs Jerry back to the first one. He shells that again. He does this till the Jerrys are shagged out and finally double back to their own line. When I fight an enemy, I like to keep them fit, said Walker. That night, fairly quiet in the command post, Lieutenant Stuart Pride says he's not feeling well. I must report sick in the morning, he says. Any music on the wireless, Milligan? I fiddle with the knobs. Ew, ew. We are surrounded by hills and the reception is very bad. I get what sounds like someone singing in Yugoslavian. I don't understand, Milligan, said Lieutenant Stuart Pride. You can't get the bloody OP only half a mile away, yet you can get some idiot singing in Yugoslavia. Oh, that's because he's singing very loud, sir. If our signals at the OP could be given training in opera, it would be much easier. It's 2 a.m, bloody cold. Edgington has just come off the telephone exchange duty. He comes into the command post for a warm. Caw, it's taters, he says, making straight for the brazier. We all stand round it, the twigs crackling. What was the news tonight, says Edgington. The Russians are advancing in all directions, including upwards. The Allies are making steady progress, and Harry Roy is in hospital with appendicitis. Edgington grins at Lieutenant Stuart Pride. Do you like Harry Roy, sir, he says. I don't know. I've never met him, said Stuart Pride. Buttoning up his overcoat, Edgington bids us good night. I see ye in dawn's rosy light, and he slips under the canvas into the night. We hear him fall in the dark and fade away, swearing to himself. I shout to the canvas, don't forget dawn's early light. Back come the answer, balls. Oh, what a lovely war. Not so lovely when we hear by the grapevine that our poor bloody infantry are suffering 50% casualties. Thank God I'm not in the infantry. So ended Armistice Day. What a day to die. Friday, November the 12th, 1943. On this day, my diary is blank. I think this is because I was always too busy moving, as is borne out by Files' diary that says, move forward at 0500 hours to new position. As usual, the digging in the crackpot major loves so well. Beautiful country and orchard, mountains far away snow-crested, lovely apples make place too much like England, with green downs and autumn leaves. Xmas greeting mails are being issued. Oh, 0500 hours! No wonder I didn't make any entry in the diary. However, I have this excerpt from a letter I wrote home on the 13th, and in it I say, today is like an English summer's day. Birds sing their repetitive little phrases. The village overlooking the field I'm in looks like a drawing from Hans Andersen's fairy story. Excuse the writing, but I'm laying down. So, where were we? The map references were 999-003, and that indicates a place called Monte Santa Maria. I never knew that Maria was saint number 999-003. Edgington's recollections. Well, it was a bit of a blur, except for the orchard itself, which is very clear in my memory, plus the view from the corner of it of not-so-distant peaks, snow-capped in a chilly autumn morning and rose-tinted in the early dawn light. The very first time I had ever seen, and I suspect a few other English city dwellers like me, such a magnificent natural phenomenon. If I can take a guess at the orientation and say the long axis of the raggedy oval-shaped orchard, maybe 68 feet in length, was east-west, roughly, and those unearthly beautiful peaks were lying about southeast, as we peered southward over the thick hedge that completely surrounded the orchard. The altitude was accentuated by the fact the peak seemed to be at about the same level as us across the deep valley and to the east. Of the apples in the orchard, we identified at least six familiar types, though I'm not sure there were considerably more trees than that. Russets, Granny Smiths, Big Canadian Reds, Cox's Orange, Pippins, were among those I can still recall. Why, one tree had produced what Alf and I concluded must have been a cross between an apple and a pear, rather small, delicious to eat, and having a quite marked perfume or scent in the bargain. I recall that under each tree there was a veritable carpet of apples, windfalls, and the scene under the Big Canadian tree was something to marvel at. The dark, reddish, highly polished skins glistening with diamonds like drops of moisture, all catching the fitful shafts of sunlight just breaking through the foliage. Only half an hour later, or maybe less, we found ourselves being nearly suffocated by the onset of a large patch of very dense mountain mist, the minute droplets of water vapour being concentrated as to bring visibility down almost nil and clog our breathing alarmingly. It only lasted a few minutes, but we really got panicky in that time. Thank you for that, Gunner Eddington. Eddington and I are off duty. To shelter from the ironing rain, we hole up in the back of someone's three-tonner. We chat about anything. We sing songs together. We like doing vocal arrangements. I play the trumpet part and Harry does the bass accompaniment. We scrounge tea from Spike Dean's. Lieutenant Joe Mostyn is passing by. I could see his Jewish soul burning with loathing of the war. Not so much against the Germans, but the fact that he was only on a second lieutenant's pay, when he really wanted to be in his schmutter shop in Whitechapel, doing mass-produced suits that all the spivs would buy off the peg at £5 a go cash. I could see his gaze, a long way from this muddy pit we were in. He was in the workshop, watching the girls and their machines, and fancying the one with the big boobs who was doing the padding in the shoulders. The times he had said to me, "Whoever designed the battle dress was a schmuck. The first thing to do when you dress a soldier is to make him look or think he looks like attracted to the opposite sex. But look at this." He would indicate my battle dress. "No wonder the Yanks get all the women. What do you look like? A cripple. We all look like cripples. When we march past the saluting base, the natives think we're all going to our home for the deformed." Yet, although he was never very good at gunnery, or as we called it, goonery, he was still the man who kept the officer's mess topped up with little luxuries. I remember Lieutenant Walker coming to the command post, his eyes shining with orange sauce. Where in God's name did he get duck in this wilderness? At the apple orchards, Mostyn detailed three gunners to spend all day collecting sacks of apples. He got the cookhouse to stew them, and for several weeks there was apple puree on the table. It was marvellous. Mind you, he was suffering. His family were all kosher, and he had started off following the kosher diet. But as the war entered its second year, he gradually became Christianized. The great temptation was upon him. At the rest camp at Amalfi, he was offered a plate of shellfish. Strained to breaking point, he said, according to Lieutenant Walker, "Why should I go on being hated by Hitler for being Jewish? I'm going to take the pressure off." So saying, he plunged into the shellfish, beating his breast and shouting, "Mother, forgive me, but eat, Joe, eat!" Yes, Joe Mostyn was an unforgettable character. I last saw him in the foyer of the Cumberland Hotel at Marble Arch in 1952. He was a bit offish with me and seemed loath to talk, but he did impart the information that he was teaching the Israeli army gunnery. If so, but for him, the Six-Day War would have been over in two. The war is gradually having an ill effect on the officers. Bombardier Sherwood is at the foot of a hill on which our OP is sighted. He is in his little bivvy by his Bren carrier when the link phone buzzes. In Sherwood's own words, this is what transpired. Sherwood: "O.P. Link answering." Lieutenant Button:
"Ah, Sherwood?"
"Yes, sir."
"I'm bored, very bored."
"See, sir. What do you want me to do, sir, then?" There was a pause, and there was a slight breathing, and then...
"Sing. Sing something, for God's sake, sing something.
Sherwood, yes, sir. Lead it, pistol, down, babe, lead it, pistol, down. Pistol picking, mama, lead it, pistol, down.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Sherwood.
Saturday, November the 13th, 1943. Because of the OP's field of view and 1,000 feet height added to the gun's range, the targets are never ending. Despite the cold, the gunners are actually sweating. A casualty. My boots are leaking. I examine them seated in the back of the G-truck. White passes by, sipping tea. He stops. What's on? My boots are leaking. Oh. Outwards? Outwards my ass. The bloody water's getting in. Jerry's got the right idea. Jack boots. No lace holes. Great. Have you tasted the apples here? Not yet. They're bloody marvellous. Better than English ones. Full of juice. Army conversations were unique. From leaking boots to apples in one line. I reported to the quartermaster Courtney for new boots. He makes me take mine off and examines them. Like a jeweler's glass, I said sarcastically. Well, he says, we haven't got your size, see? You take an 8. We've only got 12s. 12s? 12s? Christ! Take it or leave it. A choice. Size 12s or bare feet. It was like wearing landing barges. I used to haul myself around in the mud, walking like Frankenstein's monster. My feet kept coming out of the bloody things, and I had to stand on one leg trying to tug the other monster boot on in the mud. It was impossible. I told the quarter bloke, and he relented. I'll send a truck to base depot and get a pair of 8s. The new size 8s arrive, and are like iron. They've been in store since World War I. I had to attack them with a hammer to break them down. I cover them with great loads of dubbin, put them near the fire. I watch those boots absorb 2 pounds of dubbin with the noise of glug, 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 glug. The bloody things were alive, said Gunner White, watching fascinated as the boots devoured the dubbin. After half an hour's battering with a tent peg mallet, I tried them on. Great, they were soft as buckskin. We have news that 17 battery had a premature. No one killed, but one gunner injured. This was strange, as the gun had just come back from the workshops where it had been repaired for a previous premature. Oh, dear, British workmanship. Sunday, November the 14th, 1943. Regimental diary. Weather once again wet and windy and cold. That sounded like most of us. Alf Files diary. Rain making things awkward. Bombardier Milligan's diary. Gave boots another good hammering. Lieutenant Button is a greeny-yellow colour when he enters the command post. You look off colour, sir. Yellow, to be precise, I said sympathetically. No, I feel jolly rotten. Jolly rotten, sir? I've come to collect my prismatic compass. He goes to a little ledge, picks up a few belongings. He looked dreadful. I'm going into hospital, Milligan. Oh, congratulations, sir. He manages a wry smile and exit. I'll miss him. He is a splendid fellow. Only trouble was, he didn't understand jazz. He was a square. We are visited by Vic Nash, who has just come back from the OP with Jam Jar Griffin. What a bloody time, he says. Fucking mud and fucking shirt and fucking Jerry dead sticking away. And now I've just discovered I've got bloody Dobie's itch. Oh, dear. Monday, November the 15th, 1943. Torrential rain. I thought we'd had the heaviest rain possible, but now, today, it is unbelievable. It's so damp that even under cover you get wet. The only good thing is the rum ration. I can't stand the taste of it. I keep it in my water bottle and put it in my tea during the night shift. We bake apples and chestnuts by a command post fire. The path to the command post is very slippery, and poor old George Slippin slid off it last night down a 60-foot bank. He entered the command post covered in slimy mud. I just fell over the bank, he said. I thought the banks were closed on Mondays. There's a lot of illness in the regiment, and we are well below full strength, especially me. It comes to something. Our medical officer, Captain Bentley, is in hospital with Chinese flu, or jaundice. 15 and 18 batteries have been pulled out of the line for arrest, and their guns at our Remi workshops in Naples. The attack on Monte Camino was halted because of appalling weather. All that bloodletting for nothing. After the war, a note in the 14th Panzer Corps, they were defending Camino, the diary of the day for the 13th, states, The enemy have won the battle for Mignano Gap. That was the very day that General Mark Clark had told Alexander that we would have to suspend the offensive because our troops were exhausted. Kismet. Or is it hard luck? Our gunners are so shagged, they've been falling asleep on the guns. So signalers, specialists and Kazi attendants are all rounded up to do a spell on the guns. The gunners sleep in their tents and don't even wake up for meals. The platforms of the guns are nothing more than pools of mud 3 foot deep. For the first time, the entire regiment is out of action. A strange silence settles over us. I can't sleep, says Signaller White. It's too bloody quiet. We all sit in our tents, watching the mountain of water falling. I've worked out that the rest of the world must be bone bloody dry, said Edgingham, putting a damp cigarette in his mouth. Cheer up, I said. Why? I don't know why. Give me time, I'll think of a reason. Tuesday, November the 16th, 1943. We are both run across to the cookhouse with our gas capes over our heads. It's early morning, and what a treat. Someone has got us a fried egg each for breakfast. Oh, magnificent egg, I intoned. Oh, egg. Egg, oh, egg, echoed Edgington like a Shakespearean actor. I feel a powerful inspiration on the egg coming to me. He then launched into, oh, long live the fried egg, even though for it we have to beg. The fact that these eggs are Italian will have us all bound up like a... I couldn't think of a rhyme. Then Edgington said, like a stallion. Did you hear Jerry's long-range guns last night, I said. No, I wasn't on duty for once. I had a good kip. A period of eating and tea-sipping. Yeah, last night I picked up some good jazz from Naples AFN. They had half an hour of Goodman with Charlie Christian on guitar. It was bloody marvellous. Then about 10 minutes of Jimmy Lunsford, and they played that great sax arrangement of Sleepy Dumb Girl. It was great. I think Willie Smith was on first alto. What a great lead he is. I wonder, says he, when we'll ever play again as a band. Now, Alf's guitar strings are all going rusty. He's going to try to get some new ones when we get to a trip into Naples. Bombardier Fuller is calling for me. Despite my silence, he finds me. We are going to move soon. In this bloody weather, in this weather, there's no rush, but start getting things ready. We can close down on wireless, but we're keeping the OP line open. Ours is but to do and die, and try and get bloody dry, said Edgington. It continues as a nothing day. We attempt to write letters. Some play cards. Some sleep. Some just sit and stare. New disaster. The shit pit has been flooded by the rain, so it's all floating down the landscape. Poor Sergeant Jock Wilson and his crew are all gently sleeping in the tent when the contents of the shit pit float under the tent flaps. Oh, chaos, chaos, chaos. In anticipation of the moves, the order goes out that all vehicles will have to have tyre chains on. Drivers get into the most appalling state carrying out the order. Surely, said Isnan, this rain must be longer than Queen Victoria's. Let's go to the command post, I said. See what's in the wireless. We double across, giving off our usual reddening war cries. In the command post, Vic Nash and Bombardier Edwards have folded up the artillery board and are packing up the remaining bits and pieces. The fire is glowing red. Edgington and I settle by it. We steam in the near heat. It was the only refuge in a grim world of mud and cold. I wonder what wondrous fairy tale they are taking us to, said Deans. He takes a cigarette from his tin. Little Vikash, give us one. I'm clean out. Deans hand the tin across. Fucking these cigarettes. These are a personal fucking insult, says Nash, but still takes one. It won't fucking well light. You have to dry the bloody things first, advises Deans in a sage-like voice. You know, I wrote to my MP in London about these bloody V's, and I said it was a disgrace that we had to smoke the bloody things. Did you get a reply? Yes. He said there was nothing that could be done because these fags are made in India, and it's easier to ship fags from India to Italy than from England. He put a packet of 20 players in the parcel and wished me good luck. Well, we don't appear to have had any, said Edgington. Have you seen this, said Deans, and hands us a page torn from the Union Jack, the Army newspaper. I was so smitten with what I read, I copied it out. Corridors of Power, Mark 1. General, leaps tall buildings with a single bound. More powerful than a steam engine, faster than a speeding bullet, gives policy to God. Colonel, leaps short buildings with a single bound, more powerful than a shunting engine, is just as fast as a speeding bullet, walks on water if the sea is calm, talks with God. Lieutenant Colonel, leaps short buildings with a running start in favorable winds, is almost as powerful as a speeding bullet, walks on water in indoor swimming pools, talks with God if special request is approved. Major, barely clears a Nissen hut, loses tug-of-war with a steam engine, can fire a speeding bullet and swims well, is occasionally addressed by God. Captain, makes high marks while trying to leap tall buildings, is run over by trains, can sometimes handle a gun without inflicting self-injury, dog paddles, talks to animals. Lieutenant, runs into tall buildings, recognizes trains 2 out of 3 times, is not issued with ammunition, can stay afloat if properly instructed in the use of a life jacket, talks to walls. Second lieutenant, falls over doorsteps while trying to enter building, says, look at choo-choo, is never issued with a gun or ammunition, plays in mud puddles, mumbles to himself. Sergeant Major, lifts tall buildings and walks under them, kicks steam engines off the tracks, catches speeding bullets in his teeth and eats them, freezes water with a single glass. He is God! This occasion was at Santa Maria. The weather was bitter cold. The rain had stopped. For some reason, we had nowhere to sleep. So Edgington, Pedler Palmer, True, Full and myself made a giant bed right out in the open. First we laid down a huge canvas gun sheet. On that we all made our beds in a square, all feet towards the middle. That done, we laid over the top yet another giant canvas gun sheet. I'm still desperate to remember why we did it, so I ring up Edgington in New Zealand. He recalls the occasion, but again, the reason is unexplained. Me, Harry?
Yes, is that you, mate?
Yes, it's me, mate.
Course, too. What's the time?
It's 11:10 in the morning.
It's 10:10 at night, here.
Good night.
Good morning.
Harry, I'm on volume 4 of the war memoirs. Now, Roccamanfina and Terra Corpo, do you remember the occasion of the great bed?
Oh, yes. We did it right out in the open. We used gun covers.
Good. Can you remember why we did it?
Yes.
Why?
We're all bloody Barney.
I know that. But was there any other reason? Were we short of tents?
No. Yes, sanity.
So there we have it. In that bed we slept like babes. Alas for Edgington, in the middle of the night, someone from the command post told us the line at the OP has broken. No one answered except the innocent Edgington. He gets up, and in his words, I don't know why no one else heard the call. Oh, I know. I got up, and for some reason didn't lace up my boots. I started to trace the line. I reached a stream that was so churned up by crossing motor traffic that the water was like porridge. I found a break, but had to cross the stream, which was about 3 foot deep. On my return, I took my boots into the command post, which had the brazier burning. I was too tired. I just threw my boots into the fire, and waiting for them to dry, I fell asleep sitting up. Next morning, I took my boots from the embers. They were snow white and as hard as iron. To soften them, I had to soak them in water again. End of Edgington bit. When the remaining giant bed sleepers awoke at dawn, the gun canvas was covered white with hoar frost. Yet I remember I had slept soundly and warmly. End of Milligan bit. I've been feeling a bit groggy all day. I could feel a cold coming on, so I dosed myself with hot tea and rum. The 16th ended like it had started, with thunderous deluge of cold rain. It numbed the mind, the body, and sapped the morale. My sleeping quarters? I had found a small embankment. In it I noticed a crevice that was about the length of a man laying down. It was recessed back about 5 feet, and from this I made a small, very dry little sleeping quarter. There was only room for the bed, a small pack, and an oil lamp. By astute placing of my gas cape and some acquired waterproof sheeting, I had made it rainproof. About 10 that rain-swept evening, I lifted up the flap of my den, climbed in, removed my soggy boots, trousers and jacket, and eased myself into the dank blankets. I left the oil lamp burning for a while to give a little cheer to the gloom. Thoughts tumbled through my head. Home, jazz, women, leave, money, women. Money, women, 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 women. I take another swig from the rum ration in my water bottle. Ghastly. I take another swig from my rum ration. Ghastly. I take another swig from my rum ration. I take another swig from my rum ration. I run the ration. I risk the rum. I'm rum. Wednesday, November the 17th, 1943. The BBC News. Heavy rain in Italy is slowing the Allied advance. Advance? What advance? Today was a crisis day. The drivers tell us of chaos on the road, flooding and cataclysmic subsidence has all but brought traffic to a halt. A recce party returned with the news that we have a new gun position at 966-976. Come to romantic 966-976 and take the waters. Wallow in health-giving mud baths. I'm saying all this from my den when Edgington's voice draws night. Hist! I hear a voice from yon catacomb. He pops his head under the gascape. Come on, I'm off to Brecker. The rain is running down the gascape he holds over his head. I still feel groggy, but I don my clothes, and together we slurp, slurp, slither towards the cookhouse. It's a large tent among the apple trees. At the serving table stands Ronnie May and Charlie Booth. They've been up since six, making the grub. Again, a fried egg, some spam stuff, bread, jam and tea. Slip, slop, slurp we go, sheltering the food under our capes. The command post fire is almost out. Wenham is inside, disconnecting the dags. I'm leaving two new ones, he said in his Sussex burr. Left and right comes in behind us. Oh, dear. Who's let the fire out? We quickly add some more twigs. The twigs are very damp, but when they burn, they have a lovely applewood smell. Still low firing. We call up the OP. Lieutenant Walker wants to speak to Lieutenant Wright. They pass pleasantries. He hands me back the phone. I speak to Bombardier Edwards. What's it like up there? Bloody wet. Jerry's very quiet. It's live and let live at the moment, though he did a bit of mortaring around us last night. Don't come back here. You'll be killed by boredom. Is it dry up there? Yes. We're in a building. What's left of it? I give up. What's left of it? I laughed. You silly bugger. You know the guns are out of action. Yes, I know, but we've got to stay here for observation. We've been flash-spotting Jerry's guns at night. Well, I'm going to finish my tea now. See ya. To emulate the events that happened the rest of the day, carry out the following exercise. Pour three buckets of water over yourself, face a blank wall, and chain smoke. Thursday, November the 18th, 1943. Today was, as Sean O'Casey said, a state of chaffis. Everything is now mud brown. Men, machine, trees, mountains, apples. I hear Edgington singing, It's a brown world without you, to the tune of It's a blue world without you. I'll try and match it with, When the brown of the night is the brown of the day, someone waits for me. He then tops it with, When you hear that serenade in brown. I go on with, Brown moon, I saw you standing alone. And I sing, Am I brown? He sings St. Louis Brown's, then My Dear Little Alice Brown Gown. Brown skies, there'll be brown birds over, the brown cliffs of Dover. We have to be ready by midday. The only way to get the guns out of the mud is tractors. We are to try the Americans. Americans? Gasped the Major. No, we must never sink that low. But we are sunk that low, sir. That's why we need them, we informed him. To our aid came three giant American tractors. They eventually help us onto the road, facing northeast. Fuller revs up his motorbike. Follow me, he says, and goes straight into the ditch. It's all too much. We leap out and pull the bike off him. Why did he look like that? His face has disappeared. He is now convulsed with laughter. I'm now travelling with Ernie Hart. A thin, cadaverous face, the rims of his eyes look red and sore. He was a nice lad, with a quiet sense of humour. So quiet, no one ever heard it. I tell him our destination. San Domenico, he reported. Lots of sands in this country. Yes, sands, fags, sands, money, sands, every bloody thing. Behind us, we can see Monkey One truck, Webster's face showing occasionally through the windscreen wipers. Behind that, a line of our vehicles at varying distances. A sign. You are travelling over this bridge by courtesy of the USA 345 Bridge Building Company. Oh, we could do more of this, like these shell holes are by the courtesy of the 74th Medium Regiment, or this devastated landscape comes to you by courtesy of the 5th Army, or a sign pilled on oneself. This crummy battleless comes to you by courtesy of our mean bloody quarter bloke. Jerry had made a thorough job in blowing all the bridges. Every one we cross has been laboriously replaced with a Bailey. Total weight of a gun plus the scammer is nearly 25 tons. They have to slow up when crossing, and gradually the light trucks pull ahead of the gun convoy. The torrential rain forces us to pull down the back canvas of our truck. We have stopped. Big deal. We hear raised voices. A large lorry has slidden off the road. The driver's face covered in blood. He's being hauled up from below. Other mud-saturated figures are helping him in another truck. They all have to shout above the roar of the deluge. You're like a school for the deaf. We are off at a snail's pace. God knows how drivers can cope. "Can you see where you're going?" calls Hart through to poor driver masters. "No," comes the reply. "I'm driving in Braille." It's about midday, or if you go by the light, midnight. We have been halted on a road. To our right, looming over us, are Monte Santa Croce and Monte Mattoni, both over 600 to 1,000 feet. They run east to west on a range that ends up near the coast with Monte Mascaccio, 800 feet. "That ought to keep the draft out," said Hart. All that day, we were truck-bound by rain. If and when the bloody stuff stopped, we debussed and stretched our legs. There is no sign or word of the cookhouse. "I think, under the circumstances, we should all surrender," I said. Somehow, the cooks have managed to juggle up a hot meal, a temporary affair of two lorries about 10 feet apart, with the canvas spread over to cover the area in between. In it, they had done the impossible. A hot dinner. As I collected mine, I told Ronnie May I was riding to Buckingham Palace to recommend him for an award. "Never mind a bloody award," he says. "Ask him for some fucking matches that aren't damp. I have to sleep with mine in me pocket, otherwise this bloody mob wouldn't get any hot grub." "Let me help," I said dramatically. "I will consider it an honour to sleep with your matches in my pocket." Bombardier Fuller explains, "When this bloody rain stops, we've got to dig the command post over there." He points to a small land area about 30 feet below us in the valley. "We dig into that bank. The 10-9 exchange will go in the cave to the left." He indicates a small cave. "And to the left of that, I think there's a cave big enough to take the monkey truck mob." Poor Fuller. He's up to his eyebrows in mud. Riding a motorbike in this weather is like going over the Niagara Falls in a gas stove. The rain stopped. I find a bank on the road, under the cover of a large tree. With my motley collections of boxes, tins, boards, etc., I rigged up a bed and got my tent into position. It was very damp, but at least I could keep in the dead position. The proximity of passing traffic to my bed was but a few feet. However, I had a home. Before turning in, I listened to the BBC Overseas 6 o'clock broadcast. "The Germans are pulling out to pre-prepared positions called the Gustav Line. Mussolini is in Verona at the head of the provisional fascist government. The Russians continue their relentless advance in midwinter. How do they do it? Here we are, all standing still."